They did lock up in August 1945 and left, but they locked things up and they left them. And so it was just preserved, frozen in time. They talk about the importance of the work they were doing and how they took very seriously the need to keep their work secret.
Hi, Kate. Thank you for inviting me back to the Churchill War Rooms. Really appreciate it on a Friday afternoon. You stayed back.
You're very welcome.
Thank you. Well, before we get started talking about this incredible space, and this is a new room on me, so I'm very excited that you've opened this up to do this. Can you just tell us a bit about yourself and your work here, please?
Yes, of course. So my name's Kate Clements, and I'm the curator of the Churchill War Rooms. What an amazing job title to have. I love it. So I've worked at the Imperial War Museum since 2006. And for the last couple of years, I've had curatorial responsibility for this site, basically, which has been fantastic. So it's all about digging into the history of this amazing place and learning about the men and women who worked here, the history of the site, what it was used for, and interpreting that for our visitors and getting across to them just how interesting this story is in this time capsule.
So I didn't realise you'd worked for the Imperial War Museum for so long as well. Because how many sites is there?
We have five sites.
Right.
So as well as this, we have HMS Belfast in London and IWM London. Then we have Duxford, our airfield in Cambridgeshire, and IWM North in Manchester. So we're spread across the country with all kinds of interesting sites for you to go to.
Fantastic. Okay, so now it's quite, I don't know if people will be able to tell from the video, but quite sort of dark in here, no windows. It feels like we're very far underground. But for people who don't know, can you try and explain sort of where are we in relation to everywhere? Try and give us a pinpoint of where we are if you can.
So we are in central London. I mean, we are a stone's throw from the Houses of Parliament, Westminster Abbey and number 10 Downing Street. So we're in a really amazing part of London. And what we are in now is the basement of a government building, which is now the Treasury. And back in the 1930s, it was also the basement of a government building. It was for a slightly different use then, but it's just a basement. And what the government in the 1930s decided to do was to fortify it to become basically an emergency war headquarters. So they knew that when the war with Germany came, they would need a space so that the war cabinet and the chiefs of staff and other key crucial people could meet without, while the bombing was going on, that they knew was going to happen. And they looked around for various places this could be. There was an idea of it maybe being out of London, building a purpose-built site for it and all these kinds of things. They somewhat ran out of time. They didn't really make a decision properly. And they ended up, out of a few options, choosing this site here. Mainly, as I said, for the reasons of its location. It's so close to government and all those key places where the men who were coming here for the meetings would need to get here. So it is a great location in that sense. And it was already here. It was a government building, so they could take over the basement. So the poor people who were in the building above sort of got kicked out, really. They took over their basement rooms. They were using for storage and various things like that, and converted them, ever more of them. They were always asking for more, converted them into offices and also some bedroom spaces here, and larger meeting rooms as well. And over time, it grew and expanded into this incredible place where some of the most important men in Britain came to meet. And also, at its height, 500 men and women were working here, working away in offices on all kinds of different strands of activity to support the war effort.
500. I didn't realise it was that many.
Yeah, it was at its height. I mean, it started off fairly small, so you got a cluster of rooms. But it really became sort of the place to be. People wanted an office down here. Its proximity to Churchill, to the War Cabinet, to the map room as well, which is at the heart of the site, which is an amazing place if you for those who've seen it. And the proximity to them was an attraction. Many teams wanted office space down here. They were all sort of vying for space and asking the people in charge, can we help get an office? And they were always having to add more rooms and split up offices and try and get people in. But it did become a real hive of activity for all those people. That's sort of at its height, so sort of 1943, mid of the war. And later, they took over the whole site and were really using it quite widely.
Must have been falling over each other. So were the people in the offices above?
Yes.
Sort of, was that cleared out then?
The building above also got somewhat taken over. So actually, directly above us and overlooking St. James's Park, that was where Churchill and his wife Clementine had a suite of rooms. It was called the Annex for them. And that's where, instead of staying at number 10 Downing Street, which isn't that far away, they stayed there and they had a suite of rooms. It's now the Treasury Building, so it's offices. So it's quite strange to think that Winston Churchill slept in the rooms above us, as well as sleeping down here in his bedroom. That was accessible via the stairs you could go up. What's interesting is you were saying about how we feel quite below ground, right? Mm. Not really that far below ground. It's only a few metres. But people at the time, when they came to work here during the wartime, they actually had to go up some stairs first to get into the building. Then they'd go along a corridor and they'd go down two flights of stairs. So to them, it felt like they were going really far down into the earth, but actually they weren't.
Right.
It really is. It's just a basement that's been fortified. It's not a purpose-built bunker, like, say, the Führer bunker in Berlin. Mm. It's not that kind of place. It's been fortified. We've got the red steel girders that have been put in above us, and there are sort of wooden beams that have been put in to prop up the site as well. And above us is a really, really thick layer of concrete. And it was known as the slab. That was the nickname it was given. And someone who worked here called it the never-ending slab, because they were pouring it in, pouring in concrete all above us to create this really thick shield, because they were worried about the bombing. Seeing as it was a basement that had been converted, they wanted to strengthen it as much as possible against the potential any bombing attacks that were going to occur.
So was the concern about, was bombing sort of not a thought in the process of...
It was. That was the reason to have it, was a bomb shelter. And at the start of the war, the types of bombs that the Germans were dropping were smaller than they eventually became. So as the war progressed, right, they got more and more concerned about just how much devastation bombing was doing. You know, after the Blitz broke out and they could see the sort of damage that was happening, there was more concern about it. And I mean, I've looked through the documents and it was an ongoing conversation, really, between various departments about the safety of this site. Was it safe? Was it bomb-proof? Mm. And really the consensus is they didn't really know, and luckily it was never properly fully tested. Bombs landed very close by us in a number of locations, in the garden of number 10 Downing Street as well. So, you know, bomb dropped in there, smashed out the windows in the kitchen. And, you know, that brought it really close to home for obviously Churchill and his staff. So they did drop nearby. And I think in a way it's, you know, thankfully this place wasn't actually tested by a direct hit, because we don't really know how safe it would have been. They put in as much as they could, but there were always these concerns as to how safe it was.
Mm. So, but they never thought go through the plans of moving out of London. It was convenient.
They kept those conversations alive throughout the war, and they had these different sites in mind, and they had sort of evacuation procedures all laid out as to where the government would go, where various departments would go in these sort of places across the country in the event of imminent German invasion, in the event of London really being under heavy attack. So those plans were always in place, and it was always a potential option that they could build this purpose-built bunker somewhere. And in the end, it just sort of never really happened, so they carried on having this place, really.
Right. I suppose we're always looking back going, oh, the war ended at this point, so it wouldn't have been worth it. They didn't know.
They didn't, exactly.
And they're trying to do this all on the top without the benefit, of course, of hindsight. Yeah. So, I mean, anyone who's visited here, and obviously I'll take pictures and videos for people who are watching this who can't come, but it does feel like a time capsule. And I know that's sometimes levied at other places, but it really, really does. How much of what a visitor can see is how it was left, and how much if you had to curate?
I love that. I mean, the term time capsule is absolutely right, because what happened was at the end of the war, and it's sort of activity here kind of wound down over that last year and those last few months, people gradually left and the offices sort of getting used less and less. And they did lock up in August 1945 and left, but they locked things up and they left them. And so it was just preserved, frozen in time. So when you see the map room, that's how they left it. That's how everything was used in there. That's how it was all set out. And then a year or so later, they actually announced to the public that this place had been here and had been operating as it had the whole war. People were amazed by this, as you can imagine, because it is, it's such an amazing story, isn't it? And as you know, as you come in here, you can see it and feel it and walk in the footsteps of the people who were here. You can't help but be amazed by it. And the British public was, they loved this story. And actually, there was a real clamour for people wanting to come and visit. The man who'd been the caretaker of the site during the war, he was called George Rance, he sort of gave unofficial tours, basically, to all these people asking to visit this place. The news cameras came in, you know, so people could see it. And some of the people who work here were here talking to the press about it. So it captured people's imagination. And what happened was they got so many requests over the years, over the decades that followed, that eventually the government ended up asking the Imperial War Museum, can you actually open this up as a visitor site?
So because, really quite soon.
Yeah. It was right after.
Thought of history.
We've got photographs of that, so I can tell that the map room looked like it did and the war cabinet room looked exactly the same, because you can just compare them and see. In the end, Imperial War Museum took over and we opened the site 40 years ago this year. So you're here on our 40th birthday.
Oh, well, that's good timing.
Yeah.
And, There's a calendar in the map room. Is that
yes,
right?
Yeah.
Do you want to tell people about what that's set to? Because I love this.
Yeah. It is set to the last date that map room was used, the 16th of August 1945. It became operational, the map room, in August 1939, 27th of August. So it's only a few days before the war broke out. Mm-hmm. And as well as always having this site intended as this emergency war headquarters for the war cabinet and the chiefs of staff, they always also wanted this map room, this sort of hub of information, where information would be coming in from various different places. And it could be a central sort of nerve centre that people come in and get the latest, most up-to-date information. And it really is a fantastic place, isn't it, when you go in there? It's one of those places when you step behind the glass, you smell the history, don't you?
I'm so lucky.
Absolutely. Yes. Yeah, it was great. It was a really busy place. It was a constant place of activity and information. And the lights burned around the clock in that room because it was manned 24/7. So there was always a shift of men working in there, of officers. They were drawn from the three services and there were duty officers in charge. And so that room was, it was in continuous operation for over 2,000 days because it's August 39 all the way through to August 1945. So that calendar is frozen on that time. There's actually also some weather maps that are pinned up on the board and the date is the 16th of August as well. So it really is. It's this great link to the past, isn't it? You can tell that's the last time someone changed that calendar.
Amazing. It must have felt very eerie if you were one of the last people to have been here as it got shut down.
Yeah, and I think they became at such a close team, as you can imagine, working so closely together over so many years. And I know that the map room, the staff in there, the officers, they used to organise these post-war reunions. So there was a man who was one of the duty officers in there called Wing Commander John Hegarty, and he was a really popular member of staff, and he organised these post-war reunions for many years after. And he'd have to, you know, go to the organisation of finding somewhere and getting everyone together. And so
Facebook or email.
No, exactly. And sounds like they had a really fun time, some dinners with lots of alcohol ordered, and you know, they met up and they probably shared stories and remembered being here in the war. And they also used to write a birthday card to Winston Churchill every year, and he would reply and thank them very much. And there was obviously a great fondness between them, and a sort of it's so nice that they continued their friendships after the war. But yeah, you're right, it would have been a really poignant moment, wouldn't it, turning out those lights for the last time and locking up.
Yeah, that camaraderie that must have built up, and then all of a sudden it's obviously everyone wants it to be over, but not
well. That's the
that
thing,
would have
isn't
been
it?
A loss.
Yeah,
personally.
Absolutely. You're wanting the end of the war because you know what it means, but also it's this strange period of well, now what?
Yeah. And what's the story behind the sugar cubes that are in the map?
Yes, so those belonged to Wing Commander John Hegarty, and they were found many years later when the Imperial War Museum took over the site, and obviously my predecessors were going through all the drawers and the papers and seeing what was in there. They opened up one of those drawers and there was this envelope, and they opened it up and there were sugar cubes. What a strange thing to find. And they eventually found out through John Hegarty's family that, yeah, they belonged to him. It was his writing on it, so they knew it belonged to him. And that was his week's sugar ration, so he must have been really annoyed to have left it behind and forgotten them, because he got back and didn't have his sugar. And he also, you can see he sort of scraped off one of the sugar cubes to try and maybe eke out that ration into his cup of tea, because they didn't get much, obviously, with wartime rationing.
Right.
It's a really nice, tangible link with the people who were here. Mm. So, you know, you can imagine him making his cup of tea, as we all like to have one now and again when you need to get through a day. It's just a really nice link with the people who were here on the site.
But I wanted to ask you about what life was like here for people who were working here. And one of the questions I wanted to ask was, were people who were working, obviously, in the most arguably important, strategic at least, roles in the war, were they still subject to the same rationing and things like that?
Yeah, they were. And there were many people who came here, quite important people who had quite senior positions, talking about the sort of food they'd get here and sort of things out of tins and canned soup. There was someone who was one of Churchill's private secretaries, actually. So you might think they might have access to better types of food, right? No, he had food here like everyone else, out of a tin. The site was sort of run by a team of Royal Marines. So there were around 50 of them who worked at the site, and they were responsible for things like security and things like setting up the meeting rooms ready for the war cabinet to be meeting, and also running the mess. They had two messes here, so there was an officers' mess for sort of members of the war cabinet and more VIP visitors, and then there was a mess for everyone else, really. Mm-hmm. And yeah, the staff here talk about, you know, the food was adequate, but that there wasn't loads of it, and it was often things out of a tin. So yeah, that even working here in this, as you say, important place, they were still not sort of dining, fine dining.
it's always intrigued me, sort of assume, well, perhaps they got a little bit more, but
yeah,
no, everyone was in it together then.
Absolutely.
So obviously there's a lot of men here. Were there women down here as well?
There were, and that's what's so great about this site, I think, is it's this real mix of different experiences. Yes, you've got these really important VIPs, members of the war cabinet. I mean, the king used to come and visit here sometimes, generals like General Eisenhower. But then you've also got women who were working here as typists and secretaries and clerks, and in a variety of different roles. So there were many women who worked on the site, and we've got a lot of their remembrances, and they're really interesting to hear about, because they were working really hard, you know, in these roles and having to work long hours here underground in the same conditions as the men were working as well, tucked away in these offices with the, you know, fluorescent lighting and working long hours. And they talk about the conditions here. They talk about the importance of the work they were doing and how they took very seriously the need to keep their work secret. And they couldn't tell their families exactly what they did. But they were working these long hours and you know, in these tough conditions all throughout the war, so it's great to get their involvement here as well.
Yeah, it makes you think very much of Bletchley Park, actually.
That's the thing. Yes, it's very much like Bletchley. It's a strange sort of place where it was so important, and you do get women working here as well, which you wouldn't necessarily expect, would you?
Fascinating. So now you mentioned the Marines were in charge of security, so what was the process with for getting in with 500 people as well on site?
I know.
I imagine that was quite...
So it's 1940s security, so it's not, you know, eye scans or anything like that. But they were told to take it very seriously, because it so much important information was here. There was great secrecy about it. So everyone who worked here had to have a pass, a cabinet war rooms pass, and so they had to show that to the sentry on duty. Obviously they worked here for so long, they got to know people, but they would have to show it each time, and they'd let them down and through into the war rooms. And you know, there were several doors that you had to get through and obviously come down, so all the entrances to the site were guarded, so if you didn't have your pass, you weren't getting in.
So we're not quite as far underground here as I thought, but we are in a basement in the middle of London. So any rats, did they have any like difficulties? What about ventilation? Things like that?
Well, They did put in ventilation. So there are some sort of cream air ducts that you'll see around the side, and they have sort of vents in them, kind of look like on a battleship, actually. Right. So that was installed because, yeah, they knew that they would need to ventilate the site because it's just a basement. And we know what basements are like. They're kind of cold and damp, or they're really hot in the summer, aren't they? They're just not really temperature controlled. So, yeah, they put in the ventilation. And what they did was they pumped in fresh air from over on Horse Ferry Road, which is just a couple of streets over. But it sort of went underground in these, you know, metal tubes. And then by the time it got here, it had a sort of metallic smell to it. So there was also a bit of a variety across the site as to the air quality. So there are people who worked here who remember many years later. Some of them said, oh, I think the air was all right. Others said it was awful. You know, by the end of the day, it was just really stuffy, really uncomfortable, really unpleasant. So, yeah, there was a bit of a mixture in terms of the air quality down here, but they did have some ventilation. And in terms of rats, yes, really? There were. There's actually a layer below us, which was called the dock at the time, and it really extends all the way below where we are. And that was sort of emergency sleeping accommodation, basically. So there were, at its height, obviously, many people working here. And if you were working a long shift, and they did, and they worked long into the night sometimes the bombing would be happening above ground, so you wouldn't necessarily want to leave and risk that. You could stay down here and sleep. But again, some of the staff who are here have talked about that and remembered it wasn't really very pleasant, and you'd only do it because you sort of had to. So what you do is you go down a ladder. It was quite steep, and it's quite low, actually, the ceiling of the dock. So you'd sort of creep down there, and you'd take down your things to sleep with, and you'd find a little bunk. They were sort of army camp beds, you know, and there were rats down there, and it wasn't very pleasant. It was a bit damp, it was a bit smelly, and there were rats. So yeah, it was, you know, some of them have said, you'd only do that if you had to.
Bomb or rat? Yeah. Bomb or rat? I bet. Imagine that was actually quite a difficult decision sometimes. Yes. And I mean, do people complain of getting headaches? I'm just thinking it's quite dull, and then you're saying with the ventilation as
yeah.
well.
Yeah. They did talk about it just not being a very pleasant place to work. And yeah, and also things like, if you think about being underground for so long, you aren't getting much sun on your skin. So actually they would have UV sun lamp treatments because they've been denied sunlight for so long. So yeah, the conditions, they weren't great. But I do find that there seems to be a common thread throughout the men and women who worked here, that they didn't really complain too much, even all those years later, because they knew what they were doing was important, and they were sort of really committed to their work. So yeah, the conditions weren't lovely, but they knew what they had to do was important, and they sort of got through it and got on with it.
And did they generally enjoy their work when they're recalling
it? I think so, yes. And they would talk about the importance of it, and you know, some of them saying that they knew what was happening in the war and knew what was being planned maybe months in advance. And it was quite sort of heavy knowledge to carry because, as well, working here, they all signed the Official Secrets Act. Mm. So they couldn't talk about what they did to their families and their friends, who might most likely be speculating about the war and talking, and they'd have to keep quiet. It must have been quite tough for them. But yeah, they felt a sense of what they were doing was important. And also what came through was, you know, their admiration for Churchill, and probably being the proximity to him and knowing what he was doing, it probably did give them a sense of, okay, I've got to keep going because, you know, here's this guy trying to lead us through these difficult times, and I'm not going to complain, I'm going to get on with it.
Did any of them find it difficult to talk about even a past?
Yes, because they got so used to not talking about it, you get in some of the sound records someone saying, oh, maybe I shouldn't have told you that, because they'd been so used to not doing so. But luckily they did tell us about it, so we've got a lot of recollections of the people who were here.
That must be fascinating to access as well. So it's now referred to as the Churchill War Rooms, but presumably at the time it's what the Cabinet War is. What was it actually referred to?
First of all, it was called the Central War Room. And then in 1939, they changed it to the Cabinet War Room. Right. So it was, I believe, 2005 that we changed the name to Churchill War Rooms, because we opened the Churchill Museum here. Mm-hmm. So because it's, in addition to being the place of the War Rooms, which he's so strongly associated with, and he's got his own bedroom down here. We've also got that amazing museum, which is full of items that he wore or used or were linked to him. So it tells his full life story. So it felt only right to call it the Churchill War Rooms.
Now, he obviously wasn't then, if this was set up before the war officially kicked off, then he wouldn't have been part of the selection of this site. So who was in charge, and did they have anything involved? Were they involved in selecting the site?
So it was under Prime Minister Neville Chamberlain, because it was 1938 that the site was sort of set up. Mm-hmm. And there were a couple of men in charge of it being set up. Leslie Hollis was one of them, and Lawrence Burgess was the other. And so they were sort of tasked with getting this site ready. And that involved, you know, clearing out the basement, as I said, and setting up the rooms and getting in the ventilation and things like that. And then they tested them, you know, they had people come down and work here, see if there's anything that was needed. And as time went on, they added more, they asked for more, they got more space, etc. So, Churchill wasn't involved at that point, but he was involved in the slab that I was talking about, that concrete. So this was October 1940, 22nd of October 1940, and in one of the war cabinet meetings they held that day, it's on the item agenda, and he's talking about the safety of this site. And he'd obviously been asking about it, and had been told, you know, we put in some things to strengthen it, but maybe it's not quite as bomb-proof as we'd been thinking. So he ordered the slab to be poured in above to give it that an extra protection. So he is involved in the site and how it's ended up in that way.
Is that the only change he made? Was everything else sort of just carry on?
Pretty much, because when he took over in May 1940, of course, and he went into the war cabinet room and he said, this is the room from which I will direct the war. So that was very much, he put his stamp on it and he was happy with that room. And there were over 100 meetings of the war cabinet held in that room. And that's about a tenth of all of them. So it's quite a high number. So you get around 30 or so during the Blitz. And then they come back in 1944 and into 1945 during the V weapon attacks. So the V1s and the V2s. And they held 68 meetings down here during that period. So it's interesting to think it's also associated with that later end of the war as well, not just the Blitz. He was very strongly associated with the site. He would obviously come down for the meetings. He had his bedroom/office down here, and he slept here 3 nights in September 1940, so after the Blitz had first started, about a week after. So the 16th, 17th and 18th of September, he slept down here overnight. He'd also take his afternoon naps down here. And one of his private secretaries, Jock Colville, remembered him lying on the bed and dictating to secretaries in that room. So he'd sort of use it for that. He'd also sit and work there. And he made 4 live radio broadcasts from that bedroom as well. So we've still got the microphone on the desk that he would speak and make his famous speeches that we're all familiar with. So 4 of those he made live here from the war rooms, one of which was the day after Pearl Harbor. So it's that really important time when the USA has been brought into the war, and he's given this classic Churchillian rallying speech about that and what that would mean for the war going forwards.
Now, so he's got his bed, so obviously there's the war cabinet room, there's his bedroom, but with his microphone to do these speeches. Mm-hmm. Now there's another room, there isn't there, telephone room, what was it called?
Yes.
And tell us about what that was used for, but also tell us about the door.
Absolutely. So the door to this room you're speaking of, which is really, it's a cupboard, isn't it, really? A room room is a bit too generous. And during the war, the staff here were told that room, because it had a sign on it which says engaged, keep shut, you know, private, they weren't allowed in there. That was off limits to them because that was Churchill's private toilet. So that was the what was given out about it. Now, in fact, and as visitors can now see, because we put some glass in so you can see into it, it was actually a room where Churchill could go in and talk in complete secrecy and security to the President of the United States. So obviously Churchill had this relationship with Roosevelt, which he'd built up even before the US was brought into the war. And so, you know, they had a friendship, they had a relationship, and that room was where he was able to speak to them. And they used technology which was called Six Alley, and it was developed by a US company called Bell Telephones. And at the time, it was really cutting edge technology. And what it did was basically ensured that the people speaking over this means of communication, this system, they could be completely assured that no one could listen in. It was very expensive technology at the time, and actually each of the terminals that was used to transmit this cost $1 million at the time.
Wow.
So that was a lot. And the size of it was so large, they couldn't have the terminal here. There wasn't space for it. It was actually in the basement of Selfridge's department store on Oxford Street. So we've got a photo of it there, you can see, and it does look, you know, pretty large. Probably the same technology you'd have in your phone now, but yes. At the time, obviously, it was quite large. And so it was an amazing little cupboard where Churchill could speak to Roosevelt. So they had a few conversations via that. But then we do know that after Roosevelt died in April 1945, Churchill rang his successor, President Truman, and gave his condolences. And then a few weeks after that, Churchill and Truman actually had a two-hour conversation over Cigsaly, over this, wow, this means of communication. And so that's them talking about the end of the war in Europe, because obviously that was imminent. And I'd really love to be a fly on the wall for that and hear what they had to say. I'd love to see a transcription. I haven't found one yet. But
oh, wow. Keep an eye out. Yeah. Just in case it comes up somewhere strange. These things do sometimes. So Churchill himself, then, we're getting a little bit of an insight into him here, aren't we? So, because is it true that he didn't particularly like, or he wasn't particularly easy to control, clearly, but didn't he like to go up and get on the roof? I'm thinking, you know, he's had this slab of concrete put here to make sure it's bomb-proof, but then when the bombs start falling, he actually liked to go and have a look.
This is true, yeah. Churchill had a bodyguard called Walter Thompson, and you've really got to feel sorry for this guy because he's responsible for trying to keep Churchill safe. And as you say, Churchill did used to go up on the roof and watch the air raids. He also used to walk around in Westminster during the Blitz and sort of, you know, be out among the bombing. And there were a few near misses, basically. So, yeah, Churchill wasn't one to really sort of, I suppose, cower away and hide. You know, he was a pretty brave person, and he would sort of stride into danger. I mean, he'd served in his lifetime in various wars, and he would, you know, he didn't want to shy away from that. I think he also felt that he didn't want to not take on the same risks as everyone else in the country was taking on, if that makes sense. And so for him, you know, he wanted to know, he wanted to be out there and among the action and know what was happening. So yeah, he did used to go and watch the air raids.
I imagine his bodyguard was grey and bald before
his
time.
Yeah, I think probably, yeah.
Yeah, definitely. So there's people working here all the time, but those meetings would only probably happen here if there was some bombing or some kind of threat above.
Yeah, and what I've looked through, I mean, you can look through all the minutes of all the War Cabinet meetings, and it says where they're held. So I've been looking through them and to see where they've been held. And it tended to be, I think, if there was a threat of bombing, and the bombing tended to be later in the day. So if a meeting was happening later on in the day, they'd hold it here, I think, as a matter of course, because they were pretty sure that the bombing would happen later on as it got dark. So you find that during that blitz period, the meetings that were held here were maybe 4 or 5 p.m. That sort of time. And as I say, later on, those meetings that they had here during the V weapon attacks, they just held them here as a matter of course because they were so random that they needed to just to be safe. So yeah, that's when the War Cabinet came down here. But other than that, the teams that were working down here would come down and work in these offices day in, day out, really. Mm. So that's where they were based. As I said, the map room was always being in constant operation. So there was always a sort of hive of activity going on here, and many different teams working across the site. And actually, some of the people who worked here said they didn't necessarily know what other people were doing. You know, they had their place to go, their work to do. They didn't really know what other people were doing. It was that the nature of much of the work was they did need to keep it secret. Mm. So yes, there was a sort of camaraderie here, but there was also a little bit of, you know, compartmentalisation of what was happening and what the different strands of work were that was going on.
It's incredible, isn't it? Mm. Really? Now in an age where everyone wants to know everything, yeah, it would be really difficult.
Yeah.
But, and the visitor route now, all the rooms people can see now, To what extent is that of what was used during the war?
It's not quite all of it. So, as I said, we opened the Churchill Museum in 2005. Mm. That actually originally was a big load of space taken up with all sorts of different offices. After the war, they weren't preserved. And actually, I think at one point it turned into a gym for the Treasury. So, yeah. And obviously, many years later, RWM was able to take over and expand and turn it into the Churchill Museum. But at the time, because we've got the plans of the site, so we can see and we can kind of map where things are. Mm. But that was a large area that would have been full of people working on things like deception campaigns and joint intelligence and strategy and planning. And so all kinds of different teams in there within in their little individual offices.
So, obviously, you've said the map room and those were sort of locked up and are preserved. Were there things lost then in these other rooms, or was that well catalogued before it was turned into the Treasury's gym? Do we know?
Sadly not. I don't think so. Really? I think they didn't think of those rooms as being as significant as the map room and the war cabinet room and the rooms that we have now. So, I think probably they'd have taken out the furniture and then we don't know where the things went,
the drawers,
sadly.
Or,
yeah, no, well, what was in there? I know it's lost, sadly. But I mean, thankfully, I think people did realise that this core of the site was really important. And I'm really grateful they did.
Mm. I mean, for anyone who hasn't been here, you know, the amount that is preserved is really quite incredible.
It really is, isn't it? And you can't fail to be affected by it, can you? I mean, as I said, I've worked at RWM for so long, and obviously here at the War Rooms for over 2 years, but I still sort of get a shiver down my spine when I walk down these corridors and I realise who walked down them before me. And going into the rooms, as I say, you can smell the history, you can almost smell the cigar smoke, can't you?
Yeah.
And that just never fails to affect me, you know, every single time, because it really is, it's a time capsule, it's where history happened, and it's right here.
Well, before we end the main part of the interview, and then I've got a few questions for my patrons, back to Churchill just for a moment for the last question. Do you get any insights into Churchill, the man, from this site? And
you do. Because, you know, he so many of the people who worked here did talk about him and his relationship to the site. And I think what you get is, sort of other records about him would back up, he didn't have the best work-life balance. Mm. You know, he worked hard and he expected that of the people around him as well. You know, he asked a lot of people, but I do get the sense that they were willing to give that because they knew sort of how important he was. What he was doing was so important, and Britain needed a leader at that point, 1940, when things did look so dark, the darkest hour. Mm. So I think you get a sense of people admiring him. And yes, he asked a lot, but they were happy to. Yes, he could be a little bit impatient sometimes, but you know what? There was a war on, so it was important. So you also get a sense of, his relationship to others and his interest in the war. I mean, he loved the map room. He would go down there very often and he'd want to know what was happening, what was going on. And there were people who worked here in sort of more security roles who'd say they'd often see him walking around the corridors, deep in thought, you know, walking around in his siren suit there, maybe with a cigar, but just really deep in thought. And, you know, this was a man who had a lot of responsibility on his shoulders. And I think coming down here was a space for him to think and to walk these many corridors and to have a think about all of that. And, you know, his relationship to the staff here, he would have a friendly word with them and say hello. And they would say, you know, they may not work with him one-on-one. He may not know their name, but he'd always have a polite hello for them, you know. So even this man with all this responsibility, he would always say hello to the people he encountered.
You mentioned maps there. He was a bit of a mapophile, wasn't he?
Yes, he had his own mobile map room, actually. Yeah, it was run by Captain Pym. So that was sort of up-to-date maps so that when he sort of had one of his ideas, he'd be able to look up on a map and see if it was feasible, I think. But yeah, he'd always want to be to knowing what was on going on. And he even had maps on the wall of his bedroom, as you'll see if you come here and visit. And yeah, so yeah, he was surrounded by them.
So funny. And let's, before then we go on to the main questions, talk about his chair.
Yes. In the wall cabinet room. Again, it's one of those tangible links to the past, which I just love about this place. But yeah, Churchill's literally left his mark in the wall cabinet room, because you can get a sense as well from that chair what maybe the atmosphere was in those wall cabinet meetings, because on one of the arms you can see the marks where the gold signet ring that he wore has sort of rubbed away on against the wood. Mm-hmm. And on the other one it's got marks where he was digging his fingernails into the wood. So, you know, this is a man who's obviously, you know, something's going on here. Maybe he's getting a bit tetchy about something. I mean, I have read through the accounts of the men who sat in those meetings, and those wall cabinet meetings, they kept diaries or they wrote memoirs. And they do talk about how the meetings could get quite intense. They could go on for quite some time. You know, there's a lot of men with very strong opinions in that room. As we're saying, you know, through some very dark times that Britain was facing. And so, you know, sometimes they could get a little bit intense. There could be some debate, some argument, some healthy argument. And, you know, Churchill sat in that chair and maybe, feeling a little bit tense, and he's left his mark behind.
Incredible. Well, thank you so much for that. So before we move on to the questions from my patrons, do you want to tell people what they can expect if they're coming to visit the Churchill War Rooms? I don't know if you've got anything on.
Absolutely. So yeah, as I say, you know, it's an amazing place to visit, isn't it? You get that sense of history, the sights and smells, and walk the corridors that Churchill walked. And yeah, this year is our 40th birthday year, so a great year to visit. And what we'll be doing here actually is the way to visit the site is to listen. We have an audio tour for people to give them the history of the site and some of the things I've been talking about. And what we're doing this year is we're launching a new one. It'll be a multimedia guide, so as well as the audio, you'll also get pictures to have on a screen, and included on that is some of the words of the people who worked here. So we have those sound recordings, so you can hear little clips about them talking about what it was like to be here. And we'll be launching that in June, so that'll be a new thing for people to enjoy here. And then more widely at IWM, we'll be having an exhibition of cartoons featuring Churchill. So this is also his 150th birthday year. So later in the year, in November, we'll be launching that exhibition at IWM London. So that'll be an exciting thing for people to see.
Fantastic. Thank you so much.
Welcome. Thanks for coming. We don't really know how bombproof it was. They felt through the ground the vibrations of the impact of that hit.